Hey, nobody tell Jay Powell, but this economy is still going pretty strong. One reason why on the program today from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizzo. It is Thursday, today the 22nd day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. As we do from time to time on this program, we will begin today with the economic headline du jour and then dig a little bit to add some context to that headline. We got an update on third quarter gross domestic product from the Commerce Department today. The last update, actually. So now it's official. The economy grew at an annualized rate of 3.2% July through September. That's a bit higher than earlier guesses had been. And that is the headline. The context is that today's report also included a tally of corporate profits. Booming is a word one might use here for corporate profits. Last quarter, American companies took home about 10% more than they did the same time a year ago. So we asked Marketplace's Justin Ho, what's been driving those corporate profits this year and what companies are doing with the money?
Corporate profits are up in large part because prices are up. George Perks, macro strategist at Bespoke Investment Group, says even companies that are selling fewer products are seeing higher profits.
They're able to push so much pricing power that it more than makes up for the declining volumes, and revenues are up at a really healthy pace because of that.
Prices are higher because companies are passing along higher costs and because people are willing to pay higher prices. Perks says household balance sheets, for the most part, are still in good shape.
And combined with strong wage growth and strong employment growth, you know, tight labor markets, you're in a situation where consumer demand has really held up much better than anyone really expected, including myself.
Strong demand and higher prices puts more cash on corporate balance sheets. Jennifer Lee is senior economist at BMO Capital Markets. She says a lot of companies have been using that cash to invest in equipment.
Machinery that can do the job quickly, you know, more efficiently, I guess, you know, especially now when you've got a shortage of workers and a shortage of labor.
But next year, profits could start getting squeezed. Shannon Seary, an economist at Wells Fargo, says spending on services like restaurants and hotels is likely to be pretty resilient, but spending on goods has been gradually slowing down.
Essentially, as you see consumers start to pull back, that's where we don't think that businesses will be able to pass on as much of a price gain going forward.
Companies are also facing higher borrowing costs and an economy that's pretty uncertain. Seary says business investment will slow down if companies start anticipating a recession.
There's less of a desire to make a large capital expenditure than there is in an environment where demand is booming, and you know there's going to be a decent return on that investment.
And if profits start declining, Seary says, we could start to see layoffs pick up too. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The Senate has passed that massive federal spending bill that's been bouncing around Capitol Hill the past couple of weeks. It does have to go back to the House before everything's a done deal, but at $1.7 trillion, give or take, there is a whole lot of stuff in there, including a provision to make it easier for people to save for emergencies, specifically an emergency savings account that would exist alongside people's 401k retirement plans. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
It's no secret that a lot of people in this country struggle to save money.
Only about one in four American households has an adequate emergency savings cushion, enough to cover at least 6 months' worth of expenses.
Greg McBride at Bankrate says most people aren't saving enough for retirement either. And even when they are,
in times of hardship, too often people raid the retirement account. But that comes at a high cost because you're going to pay taxes on the withdrawal.
The changes in the bill would allow employers that offer retirement plans to also offer a separate emergency savings plan.
They'd be little savings accounts that are capped at $2,500.
Monique Morrissey at the Economic Policy Institute says a lot of people don't get a 401k through their employer at all, especially low-income workers. But for those who do,
the purpose is to ensure that people who may not participate in 401ks because they're afraid of not having access to funds that they need for emergencies can save and be sure that they can take out the money without paying a penalty.
Any contributions over the $2,500 limit could roll over into a worker's retirement account, says Shai Akabas at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
So the whole goal here is to help people with all of their savings needs at the same time.
Both emergencies in the short term and longer term needs like retirement.
We have a really strong evidence base that when people are automatically enrolled into retirement accounts, far higher numbers stay in those accounts and end up contributing.
And he says that's likely to be true for emergency funds, too. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders basically said, yeah, I'd rather not. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As of a couple of weeks ago, according to the United States Department of Energy, there were 374 million barrels of crude oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That is, give or take, 180 million barrels less than the SPR held 6 months ago when the White House started selling off crude to deal with those high prices we were having after Russia invaded Ukraine. The catch, of course, is that now the Biden administration needs to start filling up the SPR again, which the Department of Energy is getting ready to do. How? Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that one.
There's less oil in the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve right now than at any point since 1984. Clark Williams Derry, an analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, says a move to refill the SPR now makes sense.
One of the big reasons that the Biden administration is filling up the SPR now is that prices are lower.
A barrel of U.S. oil costs just less than $80 today, down from $120 in June. Williams Derry says there is a shift underway in how the U.S. government wants to use the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
The SPR is increasingly being used not just as an emergency measure, but also just kind of as a price management tool.
There are 200 million barrels fewer in the reserve than a year ago, and the administration will start to replenish it with just 3 million barrels initially, which will serve as a test of sorts, according to Bob McNally, founder and president of Rapidan Energy Group. He says the Department of Energy is trying out a new approach, allowing it to lock in a price up front as it seeks to replenish the reserve. That's a way to support oil prices by creating a price floor.
They're hoping U.S. oil drillers, oil executives, will say, you know what? I'm feeling pretty confident that we're not going to see a price collapse below 70.
Companies have until next week to submit bids to help restock the reserve at a target price of $67 to $72 per barrel. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
You saw or heard the news last week, I'm sure, that scientists at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab finally got themselves a controlled nuclear fusion reaction that produced more energy than it took to start. That net energy gain, and yes, there are some caveats about that, but the energy gain was a first, and it gets us just a little bit closer to being able to use fusion as a source of plentiful and carbon-free energy. And you know what that is? That's a business opportunity is what that is. And as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, there's billions of dollars of private capital riding on it.
Two stories underground in the sub-basement of the Physics, Math, and Astronomy building at the University of Texas at Austin, Sandra Bruce points to one of the most powerful lasers in the world.
Okay, so this is where the whole laser basically is.
As the Associate Director for the Center for High Energy Density Science at UT, it's Bruce's job to take care of this thing.
It's basically all on this one table. The front end actually is in this black box here. And this puts out nanojoules of energy in each pulse. It's really a very, very, very small amount of energy.
That clicking sound that you're hearing is the pulse that she's talking about.
And then the name of the game for the rest of this table is to add energy to this beam without burning anything.
The table that the laser is sitting on is covered with hundreds of mirrors that reflect the pulses to amplify them until they strike a target packed with hydrogen, hopefully with enough energy to fuse it into helium and produce a lot more energy without any radioactive waste. After about an hour of heating the laser up, operator Eli Medina prepares to fire it.
Copy that. Standing by for system shot checklist. Target in, objective out.
Yep.
Motion motors off and unplugged, alignment camera blocked.
Yep.
Overhead camera block, shug diagnostic armed.
And then the countdown.
Charge complete. Firing system shot in 3, 2, 1, fire.
The shot lasts less than a second. It doesn't ignite the target, but it produces an immense amount of data that the scientists can use to improve the next shot. The guy who essentially built this laser in the early 2000s while working at UT is Erhard Gall. His approach to fusion, those short, consistent bursts, is different from the one in the Department of Energy's announcement last week, which used 192 lasers to blast a target.
We think there might be a chance to have a maybe more efficient way to reach fusion, but there's still a lot of research to be done.
These days, he says, using lasers to create blasts is just one way people are trying to harness fusion. Some labs use magnetic fields and plasma. Gall says the basic scientific discoveries in one camp inform the other. He's convinced the appetite for fusion research is growing, and the breakthrough in California last week should only help spark new interest that will speed up timelines.
I'm actually convinced it can be done in a reasonable time, but it takes funding.
A lot of funding. For decades, most if not all of that funding came from the government. Then 5 or 10 years ago, Gall says things started to shift, and private investors got more and more interested. Gall made the switch to the private sector himself. He's now responsible for laser development at a private company based in Munich, which paid for about a month's worth of experiments in the Austin lab. And it's hardly the only company investing in fusion research.
Last year, actually, there was more private money in the United States put into fusion, several times more private money put into fusion than all the public money combined.
David Kirtley is CEO of the Seattle fusion startup Helium Energy. He says when private capital is involved, you have to show investors that they're getting their money's worth.
You have to have key milestones to prove that your technology is working, that you're making progress, and you're on your way to making generators.
Dozens of startups across the country are trying to do that. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, a company called Commonwealth Fusion Systems hopes to have most parts of a fusion power plant up and running by 2025. CEO Bob Mumgard says his company now has some 400 employees and has raised about $2 billion, almost all from private sources, including some companies that fusion would seem to compete with.
Everything from large energy and gas companies like Eni, the Italian oil major, to Equinor, the Norwegian oil company, to Bill Gates and venture capitalists, to large institutional capital.
Many scientists in fusion say that old joke about it always being 30 years away feels kind of tired now. They hope the fusion timeline is now down to maybe 10 or 15 years. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And the other obvious rule is please go right.
Please. Roundabouts really aren't that hard, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 348 points today, 1%, 33,027. The Nasdaq surrendered 233 points, about 2.2%, finished at 10,476. The S&P 500 relinquished 55 points, 1.4%, 38,022. As a lot of us gear up for a holiday weekend of football, this note, the Wall Street Journal reports YouTube is going to pay the NFL $2 billion a year, $2 billion a year for 7 years for the rights to the league's Sunday Ticket product. NFL's Sunday Ticket is a subscription package that lets paying fans watch all of Sunday's day games outside of their local markets. YouTube, of course, is a Google thing. Google, of course, is an Alphabet thing. Alphabet somehow declined 2%. Bonds were unchanged today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note stayed at 3.68%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is, I grant you, just a little bit oversimplified, but the mechanics of the free market are pretty well understood. There is supply. There's demand. They meet somewhere in the middle. If there's a need, there's a product that then gets sold at a price where supply and demand meet. Sometimes, though, that system breaks down in really not good ways. The example at hand is the market for antibiotics. The antibiotics we have right now are becoming less and less effective as bacteria evolve. 35,000 people in this country die every year from antibiotic-resistant infections. So clearly, there is a need for new ones. But the market that should be developing them is failing. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has part two of our look at the economics of antibiotics.
Researchers at Harvard Medical School in 2016 recorded a now famous demonstration with E. coli bacteria. This is the stuff you hear about in recalls of contaminated food.
So what we ended up building was basically a Petri dish, except that it's 2 feet by 4 feet.
This is Dr. Michael Baim explaining in a video he made about the experiment. The giant Petri dish had different sections with different levels of an antibiotic. Part of it has no antibiotic, then a lethal level, then 10 times the lethal level, 100 times, 1,000 times. When the researchers release the bacteria into the dish, they grow like a white, wispy cloud right up until they hit the antibiotic. Then they stop cold.
Then a mutant appears on the right. It's resistant to the antibiotic. It spreads. When these mutants hit the next boundary, they too have to pause and develop new mutations to make it into 10 times as much antibiotic.
This repeats itself again and again as the bacteria evolve to survive more and more antibiotic. After 11 days, the bacteria are thriving in 1,000 times the lethal level, and the black Petri dish has become white. Evolution caught on film of one of humanity's great nemeses.
Bugs always win.
Bugs always win. It's something Dr. Evan Lowe repeats a lot.
If you continue to use older antibiotics, they get stronger and stronger and stronger.
And the World Health Organization says the pipeline for antibacterial treatment is insufficient. There are only 8 antibiotics in the late stages of development, and only 3 are considered innovative, according to the Antimicrobial Resistance Industry Alliance. Of the new antibiotics in preclinical trials in any given year, about 1/3 are discontinued.
You really need a buffet table of novel antibiotics to be able to actually stay ahead of the innovation curve that's needed as bacteria evolve and develop resistance.
In addition to being a physician, Lowe is CEO of Paratek Pharma, which is the producer of an FDA-approved antibiotic called Nuzyra for pneumonia and skin infections.
You know, we unfortunately are the exception, whereas we should be the norm.
Paratek has benefited from government programs, and its antibiotic fits a particular critical need. It also comes at a premium. It's been working on this since the 90s and is one of only a handful of biotechs developing new antibiotics.
Large pharma companies, which traditionally have developed these antibiotics, have largely exited both the research space as well as the commercialization space. And investors have really walked away from this sector.
They've walked away because the current economics do not work.
What's different with antibiotics is when you develop a really good one, it shouldn't be used very much.
James Anderson is chair of the AMR Industry Alliance. Antibiotics, especially new ones, should not be put in every medicine cabinet, but rather used only when absolutely necessary.
Sales are low. And indeed, when you look at the average sales of all the antibiotics that have been launched in the last 10 years or so, it's less than $50 million a year, which is not enough to sustain ongoing operations in many companies, let alone to give a return on the investments.
It costs, in many cases, hundreds of millions of dollars more to develop an antibiotic than will be earned from it. And pharmaceutical companies can't count on having a global market because bacteria are evolving and spreading in different ways around the world. Dr. Vance Fowler is a professor of medicine at Duke University.
The particular pathogen that I have to deal with may well be different from the pathogens that a colleague in Greece or Lebanon or Korea has to deal with.
The market failure is accelerating, according to Jocelyn Ulrich with Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry trade group.
20 years ago, around 18 of the largest biopharmaceutical companies were involved in AMR product research and development, and now we're down to about 5 major players. The majority are small biotechs.
It is the invisible hand versus Darwinian evolution. And right now, evolution is winning. More on solutions next time. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
After the new year, by the way, is what next time means. Basic rules of the road are pretty straightforward. Yield to the right, pedestrians have the right of way, stop at a stop sign. Not too tough, really. All of that, though, goes out the window when drivers in this country come upon a roundabout. Confusion and worse are more often than not the norm, which is kind of a problem because roundabouts are quietly having their moment here, especially in the Midwest. Andrew Van Dam writes the Department of Data column for the Washington Post most recently about the rise of roundabouts in the American traffic ecosystem. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Do me a favor and tell me the difference, would you? We got to do some definitions here between a traffic circle and a roundabout, and I guess the other one's a rotary. How are they different?
So a rotary is what the older among us will be familiar with, especially from big East Coast cities. It is that gigantic circle. It's got multiple lanes. Cars are often changing lanes inside of it, and they are often entering at full speed. It is slightly terrifying and slightly off-putting. DC or Boston drivers will be very familiar.
That is true. And continue with the definitions, please.
Okay. And the traffic calming circle is sort of a junior roundabout. Is the smallest round thing on a road. It's just like a 1 meter circle in the middle of a residential intersection accompanied by stop signs, but it doesn't have any of the traditional features of a roundabout. Now, what are the traditional features of a roundabout?
Yes.
Geometry.
Say more.
So the amazing thing about the modern roundabout, they call it, is that it has been sort of physically designed so that drivers almost cannot possibly do the wrong thing. It has splitter islands to force them to turn as they enter the roundabout. And so it sort of forces drivers to slow down and get into the angles such that it's really hard to get in a fatal accident. The other innovation, though, is actually one of behavior.
Right.
And that is, in the modern roundabout, you always yield to traffic already in the roundabout.
So, look, I mean, it does kind of seem that Americans don't do these circular traffic patterns as well as, say, the Brits do, right? Because we imported this general concept from them.
Exactly. And there were some early struggles. There were some false starts, such as rotaries. But I've heard from folks in roundabout heavy cities who say that, yes, there was a little reticence at the beginning. We were a little bit skeptical. But man, once you figure these things out, they're efficient. They're smooth. You're never backed up behind a stoplight. It's fantastic.
Tell me about Carmel, Indiana, would you?
Oh, yeah. So Carmel, Indiana, which they will be delighted to tell you is pronounced Carmel.
Carmel.
They will say
I guess I blew it, huh?
in the United States, and only one, Carmel by the Sea in California,
indeed,
is pronounced weird. But Carmel, Indiana is easily the roundabout capital of the country. Like, no matter how you slice and dice the data, you cannot avoid Carmel, Indiana, because of Mayor Jim Brainerd. And he had been to Britain, he had seen roundabouts, and he thought, geez, maybe this is going to work in Indiana. And they were almost completely unknown. And he single-handedly, basically through force of will, has built now 140 of them in Carmel. When he's done, because he's leaving office next year, when he's done, the city will be on track to have just one single traffic signal left in the entire town. And it just happens to be one of the very first traffic signals in the entire country. So
that one's staying.
I don't know. Seems like they felt like they couldn't take that one out.
Yeah.
There's a bit of sentimental attachment to that old thing,
that
relic of history.
How? Let's do a little public service journalism on the way out. As you approach a roundabout, what are the rules?
Yield. The rule is yield both to, of course, pedestrians and to vehicles already in the roundabout. And the other obvious rule is please go right.
Yes, yes, that is the obvious rule. Sorry, I didn't know we needed to say that. Andrew Van Dam, he writes the Department of Data column for The Washington Post. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, do with this what you will, but I'll tell you, it kind of struck me odd this morning when I saw it. A new poll out from Harvard University and the polling company Harris. There is the standard question about whether the country is on the right track or the wrong track and what people think about this politician or that. And then there's a question about institutions in this country and their favorable, unfavorable ratings. And in second place, with a net favorability rating of 77%, was the American military, which, you know, always ranks pretty high, right? The institution in this economy viewed most favorably, though, most favorably in the whole country, Amazon. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It's new data from the Census Bureau out today that shows the United States added 1.2 million people last year. Natural population growth, that's the number of births minus the number of deaths, came to about 250,000. The remaining million or so is from migrants from other countries. And the marketplace angle here, of course, is that it's a labor market story, right? John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.